Hey, what's good, people? Welcome to another episode of Soulful, the podcast that reveals everything you've ever wanted to know about your sneakers, trainers, preps, hosted by myself, Kish Cash, and of course, the inimitable, world famous, world renowned, Jason Carnes.
Oh, thanks for the kind words, Kish.
Yeah, how you been?
Not too bad. I mean, catching the last episodes of The Last Dance, I think I've already got withdrawal symptoms.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, today's guest will hopefully get us over that, because we're talking to Mr. Jordan Geller.
Wow.
Who, you know, I think he's someone among Nike fans. He's one of those guys who his name is kind of spoken about with a kind of reverence, because I don't know about you, Kish, but there's probably no one on the planet with the same kind of passion that this man has for Nike and a certain Michael Jordan.
He's ridiculous in a great way, because what he's done and it's been very groundbreaking and very pioneering. And the fact that he is showing, as you say, such diligence, such passion, such reverence for the brand, who's better to talk to, I guess, at the end of the day? You know, and he's mad about The Last Dance as well, because that's opened up a whole sort of world to how many Jordan collectors who are of a certain age. And they didn't even know or even see him play. I mean, that must be mind-blowing for them.
Well, that's it. And I think, you know, you've also got that whole new generation of fans who are new to the shoes, new to especially the AJ1s, which, we've seen countless releases of, you know, over the last few years. But it's those stories which are now coming to life in that documentary that they're latching onto and they're loving. And finally, they're getting to see who this guy is, you know, because they've heard all about him. They've heard the legend.
Yeah.
They never actually got to see him play. You know, the amazing thing about Jordan, and I'm sure we'll cover it in the interview, is that, you know, this guy has broken two world records. So the first was for his incredible Nike Shoeseum, which, you know, we're going to be talking about more.
But
the Guinness Book of Records have recognized this guy for having a collection of, I think, over 2,300 pairs of shoes. Well, saying that, Kish, surely you've got more.
I have never counted, Jace. I haven't got a clue. I'm an advocate of it's not how many you've got, it's what you've got.
Yeah, the other record that Jordan has is one he set very recently, because as probably most of the people listening to this will know about, he recently sold a pair of game-worn, signed Air Jordan 1s at Sotheby's for a record $560,000. Can you believe that?
Insane. Absolutely insane, Jace. Seriously. I mean, I'm trying to work out who would actually have bought that. Would it have been someone like the Bata Shoe Museum? Or would it have been another institution? Or would it have been a private collector? You know,
maybe even Nike Jordan's themselves.
Yeah, or Nike themselves even, yeah. Or maybe who knows, even Michael Jordan himself. Do you think he's that bothered?
Can you imagine?
That'd be mad, right?
Oh, wow. Well, you can certainly afford them. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. Well, it's worth noting that we actually recorded this interview a few weeks ago. And quite funnily, Jordan actually mentions that he would never sell those Jordans 1. But I suspect that the hype around The Last Dance might just have changed his mind. But
it's mad anyway. How things can switch up in just such a short period of time as well, you know.
Well, anyway, without any further ado, joining us all the way from the home of Nike, Portland, Oregon, in the United States, Mr. Jordan Geller. Jordan, welcome to Soulful. Great to have you on the show. Before we dive into the story of the Air Jordan 1, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? What led you to become so passionate about sneakers and Nike?
Well, thank you for having me, first and foremost. My name is Jordan Michael Geller, so I've always felt a very strong connection to Michael Jordan from my earliest days. And my dad was a marathon runner when I was growing up. He ran 10 marathons. His best time was just over 3 hours. He was always hoping to crack the 3-hour barrier, but never did. But anyway, between having Michael Jordan's name and being raised by a marathon runner in the 80s and 90s, I became completely obsessed with Nikes.
How did you get into the sneaker business? Because I know you were originally a law student, weren't you?
Yes, that's right. Well, I always loved sneakers ever since I was a kid. And my parents would never buy me the really cool ones when I was growing up because they were too expensive.
That's something we share, I think, everyone here in this room.
I grew up admiring them from afar. You know, I always wanted the Air Jordans and the shoes that Barkley was wearing, and David Robinson and Andre Agassi and Bo Jackson. But my parents would never let me get them. And I always got middle of the road Nikes that were still cool. And I was lucky to even have Nikes to begin with. But I never got the shoes that I really, really wanted. So fast forward to the early 2000s, and now I'm in my early 20s, and I was a law student in San Diego at the University of San Diego, and I was broke. I mean, I had like no money. I was living off of financial aid, and I found myself at a swap meet one weekend. And, you know, the reason why I was at the swap meet was it was really the only place where I could afford anything.
Yeah.
$20 goes a long way. So anyway, I'm walking through the aisles at the swap meet, just kind of looking around. And I see this vendor who's selling Nikes. And I noticed some Air Force Ones and some Huarache. So I walked up to them, and the shoes were brand new. And they didn't have boxes, but they were tied to each other. So like the left shoe was tied to the right shoe, and they were $20 each. I was looking at these shoes for $20, and I was like, wow, this is a great deal. I mean, Air Force Ones, Dunks, Huaraches, brand new, $20. I went to the ATM and I checked my balance in my checking account. I had just over $300. I think it was like $308 or something. This was like all the money that I had to my name. And so I pulled out $300 and paid the ATM fees of $4 or $5 to get my money. Yeah. And I had my cash in hand, and I walked back to the swap meet vendor who had all these shoes laid out everywhere. And I knew that if I had the cash in my hand, that that would speak volumes to the swap meet guy. You know, I mean, money talks everywhere, but especially at the swap meet. So I'm walking up to him, and I've got this wad of 20s, and I'm talking to him, and you know, he's half looking at me and the other half looking at the money. And I said, you know, this is all the money that I have. It's $300. And I said, I would love to buy some shoes from you. Will you give me an even better deal? Will you sell them to me for $15 a pair and sell me 20 of them for $300?
Yeah.
And the guy goes, sure. So then I spend like half hour, 45 minutes rummaging through all of these shoes, picking out the best ones. And I brought them back to my one bedroom apartment and photographed them just like sitting on the couch. Mm-hmm. It was nothing professional at all. And I put them on eBay. And I remember actually reaching out to my parents and telling them that I had a sneaker business. But, you know, it wasn't a sneaker business. It was just like 20 pairs of shoes that I got a good deal on. And I knew to put them on eBay because about a year previous to this, I sold a pair of shoes on eBay, which was actually my first pair of Air Jordans. So I had my first pair of Air Jordans. They were the Air Jordan 11. I bought them in 96. I wore them for about 4 years. I found out that Nike was going to be retroing that shoe, and I thought maybe I could like sell my old ones and get some of the money for them and then go buy the brand new one. And it worked. Like, I sold my OG Air Jordan 11s for actually more than I even paid for them, and for more than the retros cost in December of 2000. So
crazy.
At that point, I was turned on to eBay. So then, you know, a year or so later, when I'm at the swap meet and I see all these shoes for $20, I'm like, wow, you know, I know where to sell these, eBay. So I put the shoes on eBay, and they did really well. Like, they sold for $75, $100, $125.
Wow.
Eventually, I asked one of my classmates in law school if she would loan me $1,000. She said yes. And she went with me to the swap meet with $1,000, which at the time was like an amazing amount of money to me.
It's still a crazy amount of money, you know what I mean?
It is.
So we went back up to the vendor.
I hope you're still friends.
And he got... yeah, we are. We went back to the vendor, and he got like really savvy in between when I bought him the first time and then when I came back. And he raised the price, and he wasn't about to like give me the same deal that he gave me the first time.
Yeah.
And this continued for like months, where I would buy shoes at the swap meet, sell them on eBay, go back to the swap meet and buy more. But eventually this guy kept raising the prices on me to the point that the shoes were not as desirable or as much of a steal as they once were. And at that point, I was like, okay, well, I know where to sell these shoes. I just have to find the shoes. And so I started going to the malls and to the outlet malls. And I would just ask, like, hey, what do you guys do with the shoes that don't sell? And they were like, oh, you know, we ship them to our distribution center. And then they end up going to the factory stores and the clearance stores. And I was like, okay, well, this is where I need to spend my time. Yeah. So from that point on, I built my business at the Nike outlets and factory stores. I'm sorry for a very long-winded
answer. This is fascinating stuff.
That went all over the place. So I started buying and reselling shoes in the early 2000s. Mm. And I did not start building the Shoezeum until 2009. I first unveiled it in 2010.
Yeah.
2011 is really when it made a splash in the news. But I'll tell you, Kish, going back to these early days of buying shoes and reselling them, it was that planted the seed for the Shoezeum, but that really taught me everything that I know about Nikes. What? I mean, growing up, you know, I admired the shoes and I loved them. Mm. But when I was buying them and reselling them, that's when I really took the time to learn everything about them, all the technical specifications of them, because I wanted to tell the story of each shoe that I sold online. So even if it was like a middle of the road, whatever, that wasn't like the best shoe, it still had a story that was worth telling.
Yeah.
You know, so I would take the time to do the research on that shoe when I sold it. And then, you know, fast forward to when I'm curating and building the Shoezeum, all that knowledge was still fresh in my mind from all of those transactions.
Crazy.
So I knew what it would take to build the world's first Nike museum.
Yeah.
I just needed to get all of the pivotal shoes.
That's it.
Was there a moment when you kind of decided, right, I'm going to create the world's largest Nike collection?
Okay, so in May of 2009, when Nike banned me from shopping at their stores, I was devastated. I mean, it was my everything. I'm telling you, I spent 80 hours a week at those stores or driving to the next one. Yeah. Like when the stores were open, I was there or on my way to the next one. And they shut me down and I really didn't even know what I was going to do with myself. Like this was my passion, my calling. I love buying shoes. I love making money. I love learning about the shoes and telling the stories.
Yeah.
And now I was cut off. So I had to figure out what I was going to do to evolve. And it occurred to me that Nike could stop me from buying shoes from them, but they couldn't stop me from buying shoes from everybody else.
Of course.
And I realized that I could curate the world's first sneaker museum in the space where I was running my resale business. I had this big giant warehouse. Every day, my shoes were selling on eBay, but I wasn't able to go to the Nike stores and replace them.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching this warehouse like empty out day by day, 100 pairs, 200 pairs, I'm shipping them all over the world.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden these shelves that at one time were completely full of boxes, now I could like see through the shelves and I was kind of panicking and I was like, oh my gosh, like what am I gonna do? What am I gonna do with this big giant warehouse and with all of these shelves? And I can't go back to the Nike stores to buy shoes and fill them up. So I had this idea that I could sell off all of my inventory, but then use the shelves to display the world's most comprehensive collection of Nikes.
Dope.
So
amazing.
Secretly, I sold off those shoes and curated the collection. I didn't tell anyone what I was doing. I thought people wouldn't understand and that they would think it was just like crazy. I think most people in my situation would have probably closed down their business, sold off their inventory, and like tried to do something new and different. But I looked at it as an opportunity to put together all of my resources. Like really what inspired me to build the Shoezeum was taking a step back and realizing that I had the warehouse, I had the shelves, I had the knowledge and the passion and the revenue coming in from the sale of all of this inventory to be able to put it all together and do something that nobody had ever done before. Yeah. Like you could go on the internet to learn about shoes and you could type in pretty much any shoe and like pull up a picture of it and a little blurb about what it is. But you could never walk into one place and see them all. And that's what I wanted to create, was a space where you could actually come in and see all the cool Nikes, but not just that, but that the shoes would be brought to life. So I unveiled the Shoezeum October 27th, 2010. In March of 2011, I entertained the Nike executives.
The irony of that.
It was amazing.
Considering you've been banned. Yeah.
Did you, when they flew down, did you go, hey, you banned me from all the stores, by the way. This is why we got this.
They asked me halfway through the tour, like, kind of like, well, why did you do this? You know, what made you do all this? I was like, funny, you should ask. You guys banned me. And they looked at me like it was news to them. But I don't know if they were like acting like they didn't know or if they didn't know. Or I mean, I would imagine that before they got on their private jet and flew down to spend the day with me, that they might have done just like a little bit of research on my history with them and the fact that they had banned me. So, you know, I showed them the letter of them banning me and they sort of chuckled and they laughed about the person that signed the letter, who interestingly was laid off from Nike like 2 days after they delivered the letter to me. Oh my gosh. I moved the Shoezeum to Las Vegas in 2011. And then just as I was moving it to Vegas, I did a interview with Sneaker Freaker. They asked me a whole bunch of questions about my collection and they ended up referring me to the Book of Guinness World Records, who contacted me. And they came out and did a photo shoot. We made a video. They counted up my shoes.
Crazy.
At the time, it was 2,388 pairs, which is what I'm in the Book of Guinness World Records for.
Yeah.
At my peak, my collection had 2,504 pairs in it.
Wow.
But going back to my reselling days, and this is something that very few people know, at one point I had 15,000 pairs of shoes. It just wasn't a private collection. It was my inventory for my business that I was buying and selling, you know? What made my collection a collection is the fact that the shoes were all in my size and also brand new.
So who are the Nike execs in question that came down to see you then?
It was, the first trip was Mark Parker and Tinker Hatfield and Sandy Bodecker, Eric Sprung.
Rest in peace, Sandy Bodecker.
Michael Lemming, Rick Shannon, and Nelson Ferris. So it was seven guys that came initially. And as they were leaving, they said, you know, it's really important to us that the Shoezeum remains exactly where it is, exactly how it is. Oh. And they were saying this to me because they knew that my lease was coming to an end and I was going to have to pack it up. So they actually ended up stepping in and paying my rent. They worked out a deal with the landlord. They paid to keep the Shoezeum open for three more months. And during that time, they sent 67 more executives. Well, actually 60 more executives and designers. It was a total of 67 of them that I entertained. So they sent teams like the innovation team and the sportswear team and the DNA team, the Department of Nike Archives. It was amazing.
Have you kept in touch with any of them?
I sure have. I've kept in touch with Tinker. We still have a great relationship. I emailed him just last week just to check in and say, hey, I hope you and your family are doing well. And he responded almost immediately. And
of course.
Said the same thing. He actually was kind enough to customize shoes for my wife and I for our wedding.
What?
Which was, we got married on 11/11, and the Air Jordan 11, my first Air Jordan, is still my favorite.
Yeah.
And I reached out to Tinker and asked him if he wouldn't mind customizing a pair for me and a pair for my wife for our wedding. And he said, sure. So I sent him an email with our story of how we met, and he took one of those silver metallic markers and drew our whole story all over the shoes.
What?
which was very cool. Amazing.
That is
yeah,
amazing. Has anyone ever seen has anyone ever seen those shoes apart from your wedding guests?
Oh yeah, I've taken pictures of them and posted them online. I'll send them to you when we're done with the podcast, and you can check them out.
Yeah, we'll share them. Yeah, we'd love to share those,
man. They're my most sentimental pair. Jason, can you please talk a little bit about the experience that we had together in Beaverton? I mean, it was just amazing.
Well, it was great. I mean, I you know, Jordan had given me so much help when I wrote Golden Kicks. And so when I finally got to Portland, I really wanted to spend time with Jordy. And, you know, Jordy said, well, you know, let's head out into Portland, and I've got a bit of a surprise for you. And we got up early, you know, the next morning, and I'm standing outside my hotel, and Jordan turns up in a DeLorean.
Oh, of course.
Which,
standard.
I mean, obviously, everyone in Portland drives DeLorean.
Amazing.
And which was just mind blowing in itself. But that you know, that wasn't really the surprise. The next thing I know, Jordan taking me, you know, through the gates at Nike.
What?
Which was just, you know, if anyone wants to surprise me in my life, that's
gates to heaven, mate, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so Jordan took me into Prefontaine Hall, which is kind of like Nike's museum, isn't it, Jordan? It's where they kind of keep the real early history of the company.
Wow.
I mean, Jordan, I know, like me, you're a big Prefontaine fan. Maybe you can tell the listeners, you know, a bit more about why Steve Prefontaine is so important to Nike.
Phil Knight said a long time ago that Steve Prefontaine is the soul of Nike, and that everything that he represents, the brand represents, that very hardworking, passionate, charismatic. Nike as a company embodies many of Steve's traits. So when you approach Nike World Headquarters, which is in Beaverton, Oregon, it's on 1 Bowerman Drive. The first building that you will see is Steve Prefontaine Hall. Jason and I went in. We were lucky enough to walk in when one of the tour guides had a little bit of downtime, and he took at least an hour of his day and walked us not just through Steve Prefontaine Hall, but all through Nike World Headquarters. And
it was mind-blowing, wasn't it? I mean, to see the new LeBron building, and we got to go through the Sebco building.
Jason was out here in Portland first working with Adidas and with Chris Severn, who is the original designer of the Superstar. Mm. And we were talking about, hey, you know, let's get together and hang out, and hopefully, you know, we can make this work. And we really only got together at the tail end of his trip, and I knew that he didn't have a chance to walk into the golden gates of heaven at Nike, and I was like, I'm gonna get us in there.
Super considerate of you, Jordan. Definitely, man. Do you know what I mean? Because that is just wow. That's what I'm thinking. Going there in Herzo and seeing the archive in Herzo as well, is they're two of my most wanted things to happen and occur. What was the reason that you decided to close the Shoeseum then?
I closed it in 2012. It really wasn't sustainable. You know, I'm just a guy. I'm just a collector, you know? And for me to try to keep up with Nike, the biggest manufacturer of shoes and athletic apparel in the world, is just not sustainable. No single individual can do that. Even if you have the deepest pockets, it's like the way that things have evolved and how difficult it is to get your hands on the latest releases. You have to be in a million different places at once and have endless money. Yeah. And it didn't work as a sustainable business. Mm. There were over 100 Michael Jordan posters framed meticulously surrounding the perimeter of the place. And that alone, it's like, how many of those posters did we grow up having or wanting or, you know, admiring? Yeah. It just really brings you back.
Were there any particular shoes that meant so much to you that you was like, I'm keeping those. They ain't going nowhere. All right. They're gone, but these are staying here. I want to know what ones they were.
So I have a pair of game-worn Air Jordan 1s that are among my favorite sneakers and that I'll never sell. They were the showpiece of the collection when people would come to see all the shoes. They would, you know. So, yeah, so the game-worn Air Jordan 1s are right up there. I have a single Nike waffle that was buried in Bill Bowerman's yard. It's a Nike moon shoe, so that's another one that is very near and dear to me that I'll never sell.
Hold on, how did you get that shoe?
The person that dug it up in Bowerman's yard, his neighbor contacted me and said, hey, the Bowermans were doing some renovations on their property. Mm-hmm. They dug a hole because there was a tree that was hitting the power lines and they needed to excavate the tree. And while they were down there under the ground, they stumbled upon Bill Bowerman's rubbish pit, which had the original waffle iron and a bunch of handmade prototype shoes that he had worked on in his house. The person that actually did the digging asked one of Bowerman's sons if he could have one of the shoes that they uncovered. And the guy said yes. My collection was on Pawn Stars in 2012. Mm-hmm. And the person that dug up the shoe, his neighbor, saw me on Pawn Stars and then said to the neighbor, oh, I know this guy who has a Nike museum and, you know, he would appreciate this shoe. So he introduced us and I ended up buying that.
What happened to the original waffle iron, though?
That's at Nike World Headquarters in Prefontaine Hall in the building where Jason and I had the opportunity to check out.
But the thing is, you have a few bizarre coincidental links with Mr. Michael Jordan as well.
So we've already discussed that my name is Jordan Michael Geller.
Yeah.
On top of that, when I passed the California bar exam in 2003, I was awarded California bar number 234523.
What?
Which are Michael Jordan's jersey numbers in the order that he wore them.
That's
so
insane.
So I have his name and his number.
So I know Jordan. I mean, you're a massive Jordan fan, and that's probably part of the kind of allure that Nike has for you. But one of the things I find interesting, and I know, again, you're so loyal to Nike, I always wondered what your reaction was. But Jordan was a massive Adidas fan, wasn't he, originally?
I can't imagine if he would have signed with them. I really can't. It's like I look at Nike sneakers, and growing up, it was that swoosh that spoke to me. And even though they removed the swoosh from the Air Jordan line very early on and then eventually replaced it with the Jumpman logo, my affinity for the swoosh and for Michael Jordan, it all worked out perfectly because I just couldn't imagine it any other way.
But the story goes, originally Nike were going to sign three different kind of rookies coming into the NBA from the draft, but they decided they were just going to gamble on Jordan. Why was that?
You know, I think they saw in Michael the ability to do something that had never been done before. Mm-hmm. His on-court abilities and his personality and his charisma and just his likability made it so that he could have his own line of sneakers, which is something that had never been done before that. You know, I mean, Michael Jordan is not the first athlete to be paid to wear Nikes. Actually, Ilie Nastase is, who was a tennis player in the early 70s. And then going back to somebody like Steve Prefontaine, Nike was making shoes for him.
Yeah.
The Pre-Montreal is a track spike that they made for him. But it never became its own line of shoes, like what they were able to create around Michael Jordan.
Thing was, he wasn't even the number one draft pick.
He was number three.
Number three. Jordan was, I mean, I suppose everyone was at that era. Everyone was so Adidas, right? And Jordan was like, I want to sign for Adidas no matter what. But the thing is, Nike really extended some overtures, didn't they? They went really all out their attempt to get the guy, which obviously they did. But I mean, what happened and how and why, to your knowledge?
Well, you know, I wasn't there, so I can't really speak to meetings that I wasn't privy to. And again, I was also 8 years old. at the time, seven years old or
just,
so.
Just what you've heard in the grapevine.
Well, you know, I've heard that offering Michael his own line of shoes was pivotal to getting him to sign with the brand.
Mm.
And that wasn't something that any of the other brands were offering.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back in that same era, you look at, like, the Converse weapon that was being worn by Magic Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
And by Larry Bird.
Yeah.
You know, they might have had their own colorway of that shoe. And, you know, we look back at the purple and gold Converse weapon and we think, you know, that's Magic Johnson's shoe.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, you know. Magic Johnson's shoes were LA Gear shoes that were actually branded as his own shoes. But for them to offer Michael Jordan, who was, you know, just going to be a rookie, his own line of shoes, that was unheard of.
How much was the deal worth? Yeah.
From what I've heard, you know, Adidas actually offered to pay him what they were paying Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who, you know, at that time was the MVP. He was the absolute GOAT back then. But, and I think Jordan was kind of prepared to take that. But then Nike just had to have their guy and offered him, I think it was something like, you know, $500,000 a year for 5 years, which I guess is going to persuade you, as much as an Adidas fan as you are, when someone offers you that much more, you're going to take it, aren't you? When Jordan eventually signed for Nike, when he plays his first game for the Bulls, he was immediately in trouble, wasn't he?
So I don't know that it would be accurate to say that he was immediately in trouble, but the NBA did frown upon the shoes that Michael Jordan was wearing as early as October of 1984.
Right, and why was that? What happened there?
Well, it's a little bit of a gray area as far as what really happened versus what Nike marketing has told us over the last 35 or so years. But apparently the NBA was unhappy with the footwear that Michael Jordan was wearing because they clashed with a uniformity of uniform clause. And basically there was a letter to Nike saying that the NBA did not want Michael Jordan to be wearing black and red shoes.
With the Jordan, when Jordan finally wore his signature shoe, what do you recall from these tales that you've heard, the impact that that shoe had at the time?
Well, the impact is immeasurable, and I don't think there will ever be a more significant sneaker than the Air Jordan 1.
Yeah.
Scoop Jackson wrote a book in the early 2000s chronicling the first 30 years of Nike basketball shoes.
Great book. It's fantastic
called
book.
Soul Provider.
Yeah.
The end of that book has a catalog year by year of Nike basketball shoes. So you start in 72 and you're looking at the Blazer and the Bruin. And you go through the 70s into the early 80s. And when you get to the Air Jordan 1, you start seeing colors on basketball shoes like you never saw before that. In those first pages, all the basketball shoes are very similar. They're plain. They're white and black or white and navy, maybe white and gray. Yeah. Occasionally, you'll get white and red. And by red, I'll mean like, you know, red swoosh or like maybe it'll say like red on the tag. But it's not like the shoe itself is all red on the upper. But then you get to the Air Jordan 1, which released in over 20 different versions originally, like when you're talking about all the different colors and the metallics.
Yeah.
And it came out in a high top and in a low top.
And he played in the lows as well. There's, I think, a couple of shots where he played in the lows, but I don't think he was down with it, obviously, because the way he played, etc. didn't offer him the protection that he had. But remember, he also played in the Air Jordan 11 lows as well later on.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, he did. I can't recall ever seeing a picture of him in the Air Jordan 1 low, but it very well could have happened. But, you know, when you flip to that page in Scoop's book and you see that pop of, like, red, white, and black, it looks so different than everything before it. And at the same time, Nike also came out with the Dunk, which was very provocative, you know, matching the college players' uniforms, the original Be True to Your School shoes. And so, like, between the Jordan 1 and the Dunk, those two shoes really changed basketball sneakers forever, and they brought color to them. It's interesting that it took that long, because the running shoes were colorful almost from the start.
Yeah, I think it came down to, as you know, the organizations who were in charge. I mean, we were chatting with Stan Smith in a previous episode. There was uniform codes in tennis. It had to be predominantly white or all white. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you said, with regards to the NBA, Nike got a letter from the NBA saying, yo, these shoes aren't really compliant with our uniform codes. And it's remarkable, you know, when you look back upon that, that schism, and what propelled, you know, what was the enzyme, what was that moment, that catalyst propelled it into the things that we take for granted right now. With runners, for example, there was no rules, you know, at the end of the day. I mean, people wanted to be flamboyant and be seen running, etc., and all that kind of stuff. So I presume that's why, you know, to match up with their sort of tops, etc., and their shorts, you know, it was far more colourful, I think. When you had the organisations in charge, it's the International Tennis Federation, right, them, and, you know, the NBA, etc., it's like, these are our uniform, and that's probably why. And also, I think, you know, maybe another thing, just pure speculation, the dyeing process for these leathers would be more expensive. I mean, if you're going off to a factory, they've got reams and reams of white leather, right? To get the coloured leather, it'll probably been a bit more expensive, and it might have come down to even that as well until a certain point,
maybe.
You know,
with the running shoes in the 70s, sometimes you'll see bright and colourful ones, and oftentimes they're called SMU, which stands for special makeup.
Right.
You don't see that same terminology being used with basketball shoes. Instead, they'll be called PEs, you know, like Kevin McHale PEs, for when he would have been playing with the Boston Celtics, they would have been green and white. But they're, you know, for all intents and purposes, they're also SMUs.
Yeah.
It's just different lingo.
No, that's true. I suppose, you know, same player edition, special makeup. It's like, yo, Jordan brand has never been bigger than it is now. But why do you think young kids are gravitating towards Jordans? What's the big thing about that?
Air Jordans represent the best of the best, mm-hmm. and they still are the best basketball sneakers. You know, the Air Jordan 34, for example, would be the best performance basketball shoe.
I love that shoe, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the brand stands for in terms of the new releases. Mm. But then going back to the older ones, they're just such classics. And nowadays, with Nike remaking them, oftentimes, you know, in the closest to the original form as, you know, what we weren't able to get our hands on as kids.
That's right.
It's like, of course, now we want to get them. But also, the young kids want them too. And I think a big part of that is Nike putting the shoes in the hands of the influencers all over the world. I mean, lately, the rappers like Travis Scott and the DJs like DJ Khaled and the Nikes that are seeded to them that they then share with all of their loyal followers who happen to be kids very often.
Yeah.
And now all those kids want what their idols are wearing.
Yeah. What's your favorite out of those ones? Because Drake's obviously done, you know, his version as well. I mean, out of the recent collabs, what are you feeling the most?
You know, I appreciate all of them for what they are. But for me, I tend to gravitate towards the original stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It feels so like manipulated now, where they can like make a shoe in such a limited run, put it in the hands of this person, and now the shoe is worth five figures, you know. And it's like
Sometimes those retros with the collab are worth more than some of the originals, which I find baffling.
As an adult, as a 43 year old man, I look at the actions of these athletes and these entertainers very differently than I did when I was a kid. You know, when I was growing up, I wanted everything that Michael Jordan endorsed. I wanted to drink his Gatorade. I wanted to wear the underwear that he wore, you know, whatever. But now I look at somebody like LeBron James, no disrespect to him. I mean, it's just, you know, this is the way that the world has become. Mm. But these people that are larger than life are really corporate puppets. Mm. You know, they're doing and saying and wearing what they're being told to do, say, and wear by the people that are cutting them a check. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted Barkley's shoes, and I didn't really think about the fact that he was wearing them because Nike was paying him to wear them creating this whole campaign around him and his personality to sell stuff, you know, and it worked.
Key thing you said there, his personality. That's the thing. There was a lot of mavericks back then before you had media-trained athletes, you know. They just said what they said, really, at the end of the day. They had probably a legal team, you know, back in the background going, oh, my God, tearing their hair out. How are we going to recant that? How are we going to get rid of, you know, lawsuits, et cetera, sort of deflected them left, right and centre. But, you know, that was the thing. It's a key consideration, that.
One of the things that I've learned from being in the sneaker space for over 20 years, at least, like, in the capacity of buying and selling shoes and also collecting them, everything is done on purpose, you know? And when DJ Khaled and Kanye West are meeting up at the airport with their private jets in the background to hand shoes off to each other, they're puppets, you know? And their actions work to create this wild demand. The brands are able to get away with stuff with entertainers that maybe they're not able to do with the athletes as much.
It seems to me the brands are kind of really shifting their focus from athletes to musicians and artists, really. And I guess more and more you've got a new generation of people who probably not as much into sport as previous generations. And so perhaps it's the musicians that just speak to them, you know, on that level that athletes used to speak to us.
It's just fascinating. I mean, there was a fashion show in New York shortly before this pandemic took over the world. And it was a Nike fashion show. And Mark Parker was in the audience and he was sitting next to Hiroshi Fujiwara, another great designer, and the two of them have collaborated over the years on some really cool stuff. But what blew my mind about this fashion show was when they showed John Donahoe, who is the current CEO of Nike, who was the former CEO of eBay, and he was sitting next to Travis Scott. And I was thinking, wow, this is just like unbelievable that these two guys are sitting next to each other. And like, I mean, I can't imagine that the two of those guys are like homies, but they're like sitting next to each other.
It's funny how shoes can sort of penetrate and go beyond, you know, country barriers, religious barriers, you know, racial barriers, the whole gender barriers, the whole thing. It really is something which is quite remarkable. One thing I'm curious about, considering your love of Jordans, right? What's your favorite Jordan 1? We know we Jordan 11, clearly your favorite, but your favorite Jordan 1 color. You had to throw, you know, you put it down right now. Which one?
Well, I'd have to say it would be the Chicago. That's the one that he wore most often and, to me, the most iconic.
Yeah.
You know, there's a collector named Rolo. His Instagram and Twitter and social media presence is Dunks Are Nice. And he very recently finished off his collection of every original Air Jordan from the 1 to the 14 in all the different colors.
Whoa.
And it is magnificent. He recently shared a picture of like a circle of just the original ones. There were over 20 of them.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that. That was a beautiful that was a beautiful moment, you know. Have you ever come across the Jordan 1, right, that Jordan wore when he was injured and it had the built-in strap?
So, you know, that shoe was on eBay and sold for not very much money. And then it resurfaced recently and sold again at an auction house. Originally on eBay, it was a five-figure shoe, but I think it was around $20,000. And this was like 10 years ago or so. And then just a few years ago, it also hit the auction block again. And I want to say it went for like $55,000 or so.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's very low considering what it might be worth even now. Like, yeah, things are just going up and up. Well-known sneaker customizer who goes by Sabotage.
Oh, yeah, Mark. Yeah.
He recently picked up an old pair, cut them up, and recreated them.
Yeah.
And then brought them out to Japan for an annual OTC meeting from some big vintage collectors that get together every year.
Yeah, my homie Nick is one of those OTC ones, and Julia as well from Germany, she gets invited out now. And I'm just waiting for Jason and I to get invited out. And I'm sure you are, Jordan, as well. Hey, what's wrong with us, huh? What's going on?
Exactly.
We OG here, right? What's up
Come on, Nike.
That? Yeah, exactly.
Bring us out.
I mean? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen some of the stuff that they pull out, though. Oh, my gosh. It's just crazy. It really is.
Yeah. But
they're going in deep. They're going in super deep. Do you know what I mean? But, yeah. Is there any? Are there any projects that you're currently working on? You know, what's next on the menu for your bad self?
Well, for now, we're just trying to get through this strange time in the world. Mm-hmm. I've got some more auctions planned and cool stuff that I'll be selling. But for now, I'm at home and all my stuff is at the office. And so I'm just being a stay-at-home dad and husband and just helping out.
Yeah, well, I hear what you said. I want to come to Portland, by the way. I mean, you know, I'm just sort of like putting it out there. You know, Jason's been out, you know, forever to make my way over there. Do you know what I mean? You know, I'll hit you up, see what's good.
Please hit me up. I'll pick you up in the DeLorean and take you to Nike.
Well, you just had Nick picking me up at the DeLorean, but okay, if you insist on taking me to Nike, who am I to argue? Do you know what I mean? That would be absolutely brilliant and a pleasure. Cool. You know, it's been absolutely wicked. You have to be an absolute proper G. Oh, yeah, we can hear your daughter. She's very excited in the background. What's going on?
She's very excited.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. That's that youthful enthusiasm. Oh, does she share your appreciation for shoes? Or is she just looking at you going, Daddy, you're a bit crazy?
Well, I haven't told her the extent of my passion for sneakers. Yeah. I look forward to telling her one day. Yeah. But she's got a pretty wild shoe collection herself.
Yeah, baby kicks are the one, man. Swear down, you know what I mean? They're so in small sizes, they look so cute. I mean, I think that's probably the reason why Jason had kids, really. It wasn't, you know, for any other reason but to put little baby sneakers on their feet, you know.
you found it out, yeah. You woke me out.
I was late to be a parent. I became a dad at 39. I mean, I don't know if it's that late, but I didn't have kids at a young age. And I remember when I used to go to the factory stores buying and reselling shoes, I would see other dads with their kids, like, you know, helping them pick out shoes. And I remember looking and being like, I want that. I want to be able to do that one day. And so getting to buy shoes for my kids is a lot of fun.
So, Jordan, thanks so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. And
amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely, absolute pleasure, and hopefully we'll have you on again in the future.
Cool, thanks a lot, guys.
No, thank you very much, Jordan.
Amazing interview, wasn't it, Kish? That was, that was mind-blowing from Jordan there.
Jace, seriously, dude, I mean, I've seen pictures, I've seen the videos and all that kind of stuff of Jordan Geller, and I wasn't really prepared for some of those anecdotes. I don't know if he's ever shared them before or whatever, but you obviously got history with him. He's shown you around as discussed, and I'm very jealous of that. I'm hoping to take advantage of his hospitality. We got it on record. You know what I mean? Jordan, I know you're going to be listening to this, mate. We're holding you to that, man.
Absolutely.
You know, Jason and I will come out together. How about that? We'll do a little double team. Do you know what
Sounds
I mean?
Good. And, there was stuff there that Jordan mentioned, which I don't think he's ever talked about before. So, you know, that was a real privilege to have him on and for us to be able to talk to him. So before we go, we have had some questions in from the listeners, all Jordan one related. So the first one we've got is, and if you want to answer this one, Kish.
All right.
This one's from Ratbat78. Is the Air Jordan 1
What's his name?
Ratbat78.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, that's one of the best handles I've heard in a long while. You know, props for that one.
It's a good one,
isn't it?
Is the Air Jordan 1 the shoe that started sneaker culture?
I would say no. I would actually probably say the shoe that did start sneaker culture as we know it was the Adidas Superstar. Okay, because of Run DMC.
1984 coming out, the whole thing, the whole marketing thing, the fact that they got their own line, the first musicians ever to get their own entire line, which actually predated, you know, Jordan getting his own one.
True.
But the way Jordan took it and where it got took, you know, as an athlete, etc., as well, because, you know, Run DMC were a rap group,
yeah,
was beyond. But yeah, I'd say the Adidas Superstar was the one, because it kind of like, for us anyway, in the UK, it ticked two boxes. The footballers, the football casuals loved that shoe because it was Adidas.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then we loved it because it was, you know, associated with Run DMC. And obviously, if we like football and hip hop, which quite a lot of people did back then, it was a win-win. And that really set it off. The Jordan 1 was a more expensive shoe. It wasn't as widely distributed for one and back then. And it was a basketball shoe, basketball not being the biggest thing, you know, in the UK at the time. So, yeah, I'd say the Adidas Superstar globally probably was the one.
Great answer. And especially as we're going to be talking about the Superstar in a future episode. And we're even going to have the creator of the shoe, Chris Severn, on. So nice answer there, Kish. So next question is from north of here. And so he's asking, what do you think would have happened if Jordan had signed with Adidas? Now, that's
You've thought about this a lot, haven't you?
Yeah,
you've
exactly.
Really gone deep with this one.
Well, I had the chance to ask a guy called John Bolter, who's an ex Adidas exec and used to look after basketball in the US. So I've actually asked him this question in the past, and I know it's a question I've seen a lot that comes up on places like Reddit and lots of sneaker forums. I mean, I don't think Adidas would have done anything like Nike did with Jordan. And there's a few reasons why. Number one, basketball just wasn't as big a sport for Adidas. You know, their focus was really on the sports that they were already dominating. So soccer,
crazy.
Track and field.
Yeah.
So the idea...
Because you think about some of the basketball shoes that Adidas did put out in their time. You know, you've got the Top 10, you've got the Concord, you've got the Fleetwood, you've got the Brougham. Well, that was a Run DMC one. But you got... and the Eldorado as well. The Forum, which was actually the most advanced basketball shoe of its era, which came out in 1984, year before, you know, the Air Jordan was officially available for sale.
Yeah.
You know, and the Centennial, you know, and so on and so forth. There've been some in the Rivalry, for example. There've been some phenomenal Adidas silhouettes over the years.
Yeah.
But yeah, it wasn't their main focus.
No, and that's the thing. You know, Adidas have always been such a big football, as in soccer, brand, and especially in track and field. So I know that the guys in Germany at that time, they kind of saw basketball as this thing where, you know, they were doing okay, but their focus at that time was on the sports that they were really dominating. And because, you know, Nike had kind of grabbed a lot of basketball away from them at that time, I think they kind of thought, well, let's stick to what we know. As you guys mentioned in the interview with Jordan, Michael Jordan was only the number three pick at the time.
Yeah,
so a lot of people just didn't see him coming. They didn't really see that potential. Mm. And, you know, as we said, because they already had Kareem on board, you know, he was the biggest basketball star of the day.
That's right.
Why would you spend this crazy money on a rookie?
No, exactly.
So I think, you know, the other thing was that Adidas just... In terms of the whole marketing, they just weren't on it in the way that Nike were. Nike were a real challenger brand back then, so they had to make an impact. You know, they didn't have the crown at the time, so they just wouldn't have gone to town on Jordan like Nike did. So
no, that's true.
Yeah, so you know, I just don't think that Adidas would have done anything that comes close to what Nike did with Jordan.
The way that they picked up on Adidas, Adidas picked up on Run DMC rather, back then, that was a very good example of Adidas's foresight in that one.
Yeah.
But remarkably, they've had a lot of you know, moments where facepalm moments over the years it comes to their marketing opportunities. But you know, to be fair to them, they've sort of picked it up in recent years, especially with the acquisition of Kanye West and given him far more freedom than Nike were going to offer Kanye West. So you could say that was like a bit of a reverse, you know, to what was going on. Kanye, very much a Nike guy.
Exactly.
And then Adidas coming in with the check and going, you know what, we're going to give you what Nike gave Jordan.
Yeah.
and hasn't really looked back since, which is quite remarkable. And as you know, we were saying in the interview with Jordan, as you pointed out, is that maybe, you know, and I agree with this, I've spoken to numerous people over the years about this, that the music stars have now replaced the athletes as the people that people look towards in terms of style icons and the footwear of choice.
Most definitely. Serial Flex is asking, what is your favourite Jordan 1 and why?
My favourite Jordan 1?
Yeah. I know there's a lot
to choose from. That's a tough... Actually, you know what? No, I know what it is. It's the Shadow Jordan 1. It's the Shadow Jordan 1 because for me, I remember seeing original versions of the Shadow Jordan 1 in Japanese magazines. I didn't even know it existed because I don't even know if Jordan played in the Shadow Jordan 1, to my knowledge. But it was one of those ones that appealed to me because growing up, my favourite colour combination was black, grey and white.
Right.
And that's why the Jordan 4 with the pop of red as well added on, and the Jordan 3 as well, my number 2, and my 2 favourite shoes of all time.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, the Shadow Jordan 1 is so stealthy. It just looks hard, you know. And by standards these days, it's just a colour that just sort of, you know, a lot of other shoes have gone in with. But for me, it's just so classic. You know, it's just the way that the black, it's the sort of the, you've got the black, which is, you know, obviously the darkest colour, grey, which is the next shade over, and then white. And the contrast between them and what they symbolise and how they work together, especially in terms of colour blocking, dependent on the shoe, for me, it just can't really be beaten. And I have to say, yeah, the Shadow Jordan 1.
Great choice, Kish. I think for me...
How about yours?
Yeah, it is tough. I don't know if I can pick one. I mean, I think the UNC, the powder blue...
beautiful. For the metallics uninitiated. As well. Metallics as well are great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I love that.
That was the first time metallics were used on... Well, I don't know if they'd used on running shoes prior, but there was definitely the first time they'd been used on a basketball shoe, the metallic Jordan ones, the metallic finish, right?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, yeah.
So that's it for another episode, guys. Thanks, as always, for listening. We've been getting some fantastic feedback from you, which is always good to hear. Big shout out to my Guyana boys, the AAA squad, for all the messages of support. Remember to send us your questions on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. You can follow me, Jason, at Made by Jace, and my good mate here, Mr. Kishcash, on at Kishcash1. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And yeah, if you like it, please do leave us a review. See you next time.